This is Esther, host of Once Upon a Crime. Can you believe we are just a few short weeks away from CrimeCon 2024? Well, I can't wait to meet you all in Nashville from May 31st to June 2nd for the world's best true crime event. CrimeCon is an immersive weekend-long experience that takes you front row to hear about the latest investigations and teachings about cutting-edge scientific techniques. You'll also get sneak peeks into the hottest binge-worthy true crime shows and documentaries, and rub elbows with celebrities in the true crime world. If you're a follower of true crime, you will not want to miss it. Mark your calendars for May 31st to June 2nd and secure your tickets today. Bring along your best partners in true crime and make sure to come and meet me on Podcast Row in Nashville at CrimeCon 2024. Grab your discount using my promo code ONCE. It really helps out the show and gives you a 10% savings off your standard badge for CrimeCon. A win-win. I can't wait to see you. Go to crimecon.com for tickets and information, or to our website, truecrimepodcast.com, and click on upcoming events, and I'll see you there.
This podcast details true crime cases. It contains adult themes and may contain descriptions of violence. It is not intended for children. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this special bonus episode of Once Upon a Crime. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know that I often reach back into history to find true crime cases you may have not heard before. So I was excited to learn about a new book that covers a murder case from the Jazz Age. The Bishop and the Butterfly, Murder, Politics, and the End of the Jazz Age is a real-life murder mystery that has been described as stranger than fiction. I was pulled into the story from page one when a woman is found brutally murdered along the side of a road. The events that unfold from there include blackmail, sex scandals, and corruption at the highest level of New York State and local governments. The Bishop and the Butterfly is a real page-turner that I know you're going to want to read. I have two copies of the book to give away, so stay tuned at the end of the episode to find out how you can score a copy. But first, I was pleased to speak with the author of The Bishop and the Butterfly, Michael Wohlreich. Michael is the author of a critically acclaimed book about Theodore Roosevelt, and his writing has appeared in notable publications, including The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, and New York Magazine. Without further delay, here's my conversation with Michael Wohlreich. In 1931, a stylishly dressed woman named Vivian Gordon left her Manhattan apartment for a night out. The following morning, her body was found in a gully in the Bronx's Van Cortlandt Park. She'd been strangled to death with a rope found wrapped tightly around her neck. A search of her apartment during the investigation revealed diaries written in Gordon's hand that listed the names of hundreds of rich and powerful men she'd seduced and blackmailed. The names included gangsters, prominent businessmen, and politicians. But there was one other clue found that may have led to Gordon's murder, a letter from an anti-corruption commission established by then New York Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt. The commission had uncovered a police conspiracy to frame women as prostitutes. Vivian Gordon was invited to appear before the vice committee to, in her words, tell the whole story of this dirty frame-up. Just days before the scheduled meeting, she was murdered. Her murder launched a series of investigations that exposed corruption that reached the top levels of the city and state governments and brought down Tammany Hall, the powerful and corrupt political machine that had run New York City for a century. There is so much crime and scandals and intrigue in this book that I haven't even scratched the surface in that very, very brief introduction. So let me introduce my special guest. He's the author of The Bishop and the Butterfly. I want to welcome him to the show to help me with all these details. Welcome, Michael Wohlreich.
Thank you, Esther. It's an honor to be here. I'm delighted to talk with you and your listeners about what happened back in 1931 in New York City.
Yeah. First of all, The Bishop and the Butterfly, it is such a story. It's quite a story. I mean, I got to say, as I was reading it, I am like picturing it like a movie. It's like a movie script. There's so much going on here, but the way it unfolds, it's like you can see scenes, and it brought to mind like the story of Chicago, like the movie Chicago or the play Chicago, and that story that comes, you know, came that it came from some real life crime story and trials and things like that. And this kind of calls to mind that type of story, but I had never heard about this. So that's my first question is, how did you find out about this story? And what, it's a kind of a silly question, but I'll ask it anyway. What made you want to write about it? Like write a whole book about it?
Yeah. I mean, it was a lucky find, I guess. My previous books have been about politics, some contemporary politics. My last one was historical politics about Theodore Roosevelt. And so I was kind of digging around FDR's history. And he's been, you know, certainly much has been written about his presidency, but not as much about his time as governor of New York. No one really knows about it. And for good reason, because he didn't actually do a lot as governor. He was kind of preparing, you know, he saw it as a stepping stone to run for president. But one of the things that happened during his time as governor was he started this anti-corruption investigation led by a man named Samuel Seabury, who's the bishop. His nickname is the bishop, so he's the bishop in the title of the book. And Seabury was investigating what was going on, all the corruption in New York City. And, you know, I found this reference to a woman named Vivian Gordon, whose murder got tied up with this investigation. And I was like, who's Vivian Gordon? And started digging into her story and discovered it was just this fascinating story that once upon, you know, a century ago, back in 1931, was huge news. It was like, you know, the New York City papers headlines covered it for months, not just New York City. It was national news. I found international news. I found references in Sydney, Australia, and Singapore to this story. So it was such a huge story about this woman, Vivian Gordon, who the press referred to as a Broadway butterfly. So she's the butterfly in the title. And the book is about these two stories, the anti-corruption investigation that ultimately took down the mayor of New York City, and the murder investigation of Vivian Gordon. And they're separate stories, but intertwined.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the things that I was surprised about, was that it was such a big story then. And yet, I would imagine that most people who pick up this book probably have never heard of that, about it. So it's amazing to me how these things get kind of lost to time. But yeah, because there is, it really does have everything in it that you could think of. I mean, there's the murder, of course, and there's politics, and there's bribery, and there's gangsters, and there's, you know, political corruption, and there's lots of sex. I mean, behind the scenes going on, and a lot of money. So it's all the things that people are very intrigued by when we look at like a true crime story. It usually has one or two of those elements, and this has like everything. So that is, you know, it was really, I mean, I can see why it was such a big story back in the day. But then, of course, it also was, like you said, tied to this whole, the corruption that was going on. So you want to talk a little bit about, you know, because that's another whole another story, but about the corruption that was going on in politics, because this was longstanding, right, that this had been happening as far as New York and probably, you know, elsewhere, but definitely New York.
New York at that time, most big cities were run by, they were called political machines. There were these corrupt organizations with power brokers running them, unelected power brokers who would, you know, the bosses of these machines would choose, you know, which nominees, you know, who would be nominated for, you know, whichever party they were in control of. But, you know, the biggest, the oldest, arguably the most corrupt was Tammany Hall, which was the political machine associated with the Democratic Party in New York City. And the bosses of Tammany Hall were so powerful that they could basically handpick, you know, who the mayor would be. They could handpick the Democratic nominee, and the Democratic nominee almost always won the election because it was a Democratic city. But not just in the city, New York City was so big that they had, you know, a ton of delegates at the state, so they could, you know, play kingmaker for who was governor of New York. And even at the federal level, I mean, New York City was almost a tenth of the American population. So they had so many delegates that they could send them to the national convention and have a huge influence on who became the presidential Democratic nominee.
Wow.
And they were, and you know, these organizations were, of course, completely corrupt because there was no accountability. The bosses, you know, saw these organizations as, you know, opportunities and tools to enrich themselves, and not just the bosses, but all the way down the chain. And so there were numerous corruptions, you know, building inspectors and judges and all that. But the one that, you know, plays a central role in the book that this guy Samuel Seabury uncovered and was connected with Vivian Gordon was he discovered a plot by some crooked vice cops and defense attorneys and bondsmen and prosecutors in a criminal court in New York City. It was the women's court. It was just for women. And they were framing innocent women for prostitution and essentially shaking them down. You know, if the women paid a fee, then everyone would get a little cut and the woman would get off. And if she couldn't afford the fee, then invariably she was convicted and her life was ruined.
Yeah. I mean, I was dreaming. I was like, what was the motivation for that? Was it just money or was there something else? You know, that is just so strange to me. I mean, there's so many things they could focus on, right? I mean, even if they wanted to shake people down, was this prohibition was happening at this time? I mean, there was all kinds of things happening. So, like, why this? And innocent women, I mean, there was definitely prostitution going on. And what did you uncover as far as that? Was there anything that kind of leapt out at you about why this would be happening?
Well, these were the Vice Squad. And the Vice Squad had a reputation of being pretty corrupt. And so they had other targets. Certainly, they were also the ones who would arrest gamblers and raid casinos. So they would get, you know, the casinos would pay them protection money. The brothels would pay them protection money because prostitution was another big part of their business, their operations. But, you know, they also found that even just with individual, you know, they basically would try to get money any way they could. And they found they could get, you know, a fair amount of money from individual women. And I think it probably started, they were just trying to hit their numbers and, you know, arrest, you know, any number of people that they suspected of being sex workers. But then I don't know exactly how this conspiracy evolved, but they found they could make money on it. And the cops, they were Tammany Hall cops, and they saw their job. They saw their salary as only a part of their compensation, and the other part they would get from corrupt means.
Yeah, it was funny. Some of these government workers and had, you know, tons of money and property and stuff. Like, no, I don't think you made that on your salary. You know, I don't think that happened. So I want to talk about Vivian Gordon, who her name was Benita Franklin Bischoff after her marriage. I just found her such a fascinating character. There were so many things that you can point to, you know, as far as her strengths, but also her weaknesses, things that kind of created the story to unravel the way it did. And just really quickly, I want to go through some of this, but there's specific things I want you to speak to, because I think I would imagine doing research on her that you kind of felt like you got a little bit into maybe her state of mind or what was going on for her, or what her circumstances were and how she responded to those. I thought it was really, really interesting. Of course, we're talking about the murder victim at the beginning of the book of Vivian Gordon, which was the name she was going by at that time. But, you know, I mean, just briefly, you know, going from this middle class background to then, you know, being raised in an orphanage from the age, I think maybe it was 8 or 9-ish. And then we find out, you know, she's musically gifted. She's an actress, a performer. But then she, you know, does what most women in those days do, found a husband, settled down, had a child. And then they call her a stage mother to her daughter, who is also named Benita, which is her given name. But talk a little bit about that. But then I want to get to this relationship with her daughter, because I think this really is a linchpin to everything else that happens, at least in my mind, or the way that I came at the story. it's just a really big event in her life, having her daughter and then having her daughter taken away from her. So if you want to just talk a little bit about just Benita or Vivian Gordon's, you know, upbringing and how that all unfolded.
Naked confidence. What is it? Well, simply put, it's feeling good in your own skin. What gives me naked confidence? Mastering a new skill, like playing a new song on my guitar or conquering one more hill on my mountain bike. It just gives me a sense that I can do anything I set out to accomplish. A very close second giving me that feeling of naked confidence would be Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. Unlike certain other deodorants, Lumi is powered by mandelic acid to, get this, deliver 72-hour odor control everywhere, from pits to feet and everywhere in between. That's why it's called Whole Body Deodorant. Get it? I love that Lumi is safe to use anywhere on my body to give me an all-day fresh, confident feeling. I also love that Lumi deodorant is baking soda-free and paraben-free. Some of my favorite Lumi products besides their awesome stick deodorants are their body washes and acidified deodorant wipes. Throw a pack of Lumi's deodorant wipes in your backpack or gym bag, and you can feel naked confidence on the go. Plus, they come in a variety of scents I love. Two of my faves are soft powder and toasted coconut, but you can also opt for unscented versions of Lumi products. New customers get 15% off all Lumi products with our exclusive code and link. Use code ONCE at LumiDeodorant.com. That's LumiDeodorant.com. And Lumi Starter Pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, and two free products of your choice, like a mini body wash and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for my listeners, new customers get 15% off all Lumi products with our exclusive code. And if you combine the 15% off with the already discounted starter pack, that equals over 40% off the starter pack. Use code ONCE for 15% off your first purchase at LumiDeodorant.com. That's code ONCE at LumiDeodorant.com. Hey guys, this is Esther, host of Once Upon a Crime. I've got an exciting opportunity that I'm so psyched to share with you. How would you like to travel the world with me? My second love after true crime is seeing the world. Now, I've been given the opportunity to host trips to destinations around the world and bring you, my listeners and friends of the show, along with me. But I need your help. I need your input to plan these trips. Where would you like to go? What kind of activities would you like to enjoy? Would you like to visit a city like New York, London, or Mexico City and check out the local entertainment, culture, and nightlife? Or would you prefer a tropical getaway like Bali or the Caribbean for laid-back sightseeing and beach days? Or anything in between? How about crossing off that trip to Turkey or Indonesia or Italy off your bucket list? Click on the link in the show notes to complete a short 2-minute survey and tell me what kind of travel you're most interested in. And I'll keep you informed about upcoming trips as soon as they're confirmed. We'll plan trips around your interests and budget, and we'll travel together as a small group. There's safety in numbers too, so single men and women are encouraged. Or bring your significant other or best friends along. Either way, it will be a blast. Click on the survey link right away. The sooner we get your responses, the sooner we'll be on the road together to new adventures. Thank you so much, and I can't wait to travel with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talked a little bit about her childhood. It was definitely, it was a difficult childhood. I think it was, you know, it's hard. I'm trying to read between the lines here because there's not a lot of information about her childhood. She and all her siblings were in an orphanage at one point. And then at a later point, her father sued her mother for divorce, claiming that she tried to poison him. So I suspect, and from other hints that I got, that her mother was not a great mother, probably abusing, alcohol or drugs. And that's how the children ended up in the orphanage. The father was didn't even work in the same city. He was a warden and, in Chicago, and they were in the family was living in Indiana. So she had this troubled childhood. She eventually, her father sent her to a Catholic school, boarding school, and she attempted suicide a couple of times there and eventually dropped out. So she had a difficult time, but she was very talented. Everyone would talk about her musical talent, her artistic talent. And, you know, when she grew up, she started to get things together. She became a vaudeville actor, and she would travel up and down the East Coast performing. You know, she was never big time, but performing in theater for audiences. And it was while she was doing that she met her husband. His name was John Bischoff, and they settled down in Philadelphia and had a daughter who, as you mentioned, was also named Benita. I'll call the mother Vivian Gordon, because that's how most people knew her, and that helps avoid any confusion. So Vivian adored her daughter. It was just, you know, she was so devoted, and this daughter was her whole world to her. And I do think she was trying to be the mother to her daughter that her own mother had not been.
Right.
But she also, you know, she did have a flaw as a parent that certainly not the only one, where she, I think, transferred her ambitions onto her daughter. You know, she never really made it big time in the stage, and her daughter was actually a very talented dancer, even as and was performing on professional stages in Philadelphia, even when she was like 7 years old. And Vivian Gordon wanted her daughter Benita to be a star. There were many of the stars of that era had gotten their start acting as children. So Vivian Gordon wanted this for Benita, and she and her husband, John Bischoff, fought about it a lot. She ended up leaving him and taking her daughter to New York City, and they rented a hotel room near Times Square, and she would send her daughter out on auditions. And it was there at this time, and it was in 1923, that something happened that then changed the course of her life and ultimately had an impact on New York City's history.
Right. Yeah. You know, and that was what you're talking about with her daughter, like wanting her to kind of follow in her footsteps as far as performing and things like that. And, you know, we call them stage mothers, and, you know, the ambition and wanting the child to, you know, maybe have more success than they did. But there was something about that really called me, that the fact that I mean, the fact that too, that she's got the same name as her daughter, you know, is just like, okay, go on, you know. But it's like, it's almost like she was re-raising herself. You know what I mean? Like, so she's the mother that he said that she never had. And so she's also, not only is she nurturing her daughter and giving her that, but she's also like nurturing herself for the first time. And then, so everything that she's doing for her daughter is kind of like, you know, like almost like a healing for herself, right? This is the way I think. Of course, you know, I go down these human psychology rabbit holes. This is just what I do.
I think it's really insightful. Actually, I hadn't thought of it quite in that way, but I think that to me that makes a lot of sense. So
yeah. I think there's a lot of parents who have this, you know, ambition for their child that maybe they didn't reach. Do a little bit of that, but looking at her background, you could see that she needed a lot of that. Like, she didn't get the mothering. She was, you know, taken away from her mother. You know, and even when she was with her mother, I think her sister said something that we were kind of, you know, raised ourselves. And I thought, well, yes, that just shows you that was something that was very much missing. So then she has this daughter, and having a daughter, you know, and it wasn't a son, it was a daughter. And then, you know, having the same name, the daughter has the same, you know, kind of, you know, gifts that she does as far as, you know, performing and dancing and things. And then, so of course, that all kind of plays into that stage mother thing. But yeah, this, what I think, even the social worker type lady later on, who was not very generous to Vivian, you know, as far as her character also, but she did say, you know, this was her, like, her daughter was everything to her. This was her happiness. This was what she said, I've never seen a mother love like I saw Vivian towards her daughter. And I thought, there you go. See there, because she, again, it's all wrapped up also in herself as well, but it was. But then, like you said, something happens and then she ends up losing everything. So tell us, like, how that came about.
So she was there living in, you know, living in this hotel in New York City. And at some point, I think, you know, they had been getting supports from her husband, John Bischoff. At some point, he cut her off and she was tight for money. And she was also started dating other men. In March, I believe it was March 9th, 1923, she was arrested by a very handsome vice cop who was working undercover, who, you know, said that she had solicited him for sex. The way she described it later to her parole officer is that she had met this handsome man and he said he had money, and, you know, she told him her sob story, and he slipped $20 into her sock. And, you know, that's, you know, marked 20, and then he arrested her. And she was taken down to the criminal court, the women's court. She, on the advice of her lawyer, she pleaded guilty and begged for the mercy of the judge, which she did not receive. She was first time offense. She had a young daughter. She should have been paroled. But the judge sentenced her to a reformatory upstate. While she was there, John Bischoff sued for divorce and sued for full custody of her daughter, Benita, and took her back to Philadelphia and never let her see her daughter again. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine how devastating this was for her. This one stroke, she had lost her daughter. She had lost her reputation. She had lost everything that she had. And she believed that despite any guilty, she believed that she was innocent. And she told parole officer that she believed her ex-husband, Bischoff, John Bischoff, and the vice cop, whose name was the handsome vice cop, his name was Andrew McLaughlin. She believed that they had conspired to frame her for prostitution. And she nursed this grievance. So she was, you know, the Bedford Reformatory was this awful place. It was supposed to reform young women and help them help them learn how to be responsible adults. But in her case, it was quite the opposite. I mean, she learned there were other more hardened criminals there, and she learned, as she put it, everything there is to know in the underworld.
Right.
And when she got out of Bedford, you know, she now had like many the other inmates, she was now branded, you know, as a sex worker, and it made it difficult for her to get a, you know, lawful job. And so she then went into life crime, and she started off as essentially a high-end prostitute. She worked in the brothels, but she was, you know, she was, as some people put it, a cut above ordinary women. She was very intelligent, very talented, very sophisticated, and so she was, you know, became much more of an escort, and she would, you know, entertain, you know, the brothels at that time was a big scene there. Men and, you know, intellectuals and even women would go and hang out in the salons, and be entertained and drink. And, you know, Vivian Gordon was very good at this type of thing. And then she started, you know, building her own operation. She employed cabbies and busboys who would steer prospects to her. A lot of times she did what they called gold digging. She would, you know, just, you know, get start dating these men and get gifts from them. But then also, once the affair was over, she would blackmail them, threatening to create a scene or draw attention.
Right.
Yeah. So that's how she got this list. You know, that's how she had all these black books with all these names, because there were, you know, a lot of prominent men that she interacted with. And this was, she also recruited young women who, and sort of taught them her, she called them her young 49ers, because they were mining for gold like her. But all this time she was nursing this anger and this bitterness. Like, she became, you know, after she lost her daughter, after she was sentenced, she, you know, became very bitter and vindictive and angry. And, you know, sort of, you know, her moral compass disappeared at that point. And she was really just a different woman and with a different name. So that was, you know, it was after Bedford that she adopted the alias Vivian Gordon.
So the reformatory thing, just to go back real quick, that was wild to me because, okay, you think a reformatory, you think it's like, you know, very young people, children, you know, teenage, you know, whatever, that they're running the streets or maybe they're orphans or whatever. And then they're doing these petty crimes and they go to reformatory and, you know, they finish school and, you know, maybe this were women. She was 31 when she was reformed. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And they gave her 6 months, but she did over 2 years there before she actually was completely released, something like that.
Yeah, she was in and out. She was paroled in 6 months and then was sent back. One of the reasons she was sent back at one point was crossing state lines because she tried to go to Philadelphia to a court there to, you know, regain custody of her daughter. And in doing so, violated her parole and was sent back to Bedford. It's not clear. She was back a few times, so it's not clear what exactly was going on. But yes, it was 2 years before she was finally freed and freed from parole.
So then this takes us up to about what, the late 1920s, was it? Something like that, when she was running her operation and all of this was happening.
It was the roaring 20s and it was a perfect time for a woman like Vivian Gordon. There were all these men with big libidos and swollen wallets because they've all been, you know, making money in the stock market.
Right.
So they're handing out money. There was, you know, one of the men she would hang around with was a millionaire, and he would go out with a money belt, and, you know, all night long he would hand out, you know, 20s or $100 bills even to, you know, young women who caught his fancy. So, you know, this was the time, and she did quite well for herself. She was able to invest in real estate in New York City. She invested in the stock market. She loaned money to gangsters. She financed bank robbery or attempted bank robbery in Oslo, Norway, of all places. So she was doing quite well until the stock market crashed.
Right.
And that's, you know, that was a big problem for many New Yorkers, and it destroyed her investments, both her real estate and her stock investments, and it dried up her income because the men who she'd been preying upon no longer had, you know, were no longer quite so free with their money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the revenge aspect, that this really just ate at her all of this time, you know, like I said, losing everything, and especially, you know, her daughter and her reputation. And she talked about having this education while she was in, you know, in the reformatory, like, and I think she wrote to her sister saying that, you know, I'm a quick study, you know, kind of like, I'm going to learn what I need to learn from these women. It was a terrible thing, but I'm going to learn what I need to learn. And she did. And this is how she became so successful, you know, independently, basically on her own. I mean, of course, taking from people, but figuring this out and doing this. But the need for revenge, and that, I feel like that was a big part of her downfall. And the thing that, I mean, I'm reading the book and I'm like, no, stop writing letters to people. It's not going to end well. You're telling them what you're going to do. Don't show your hand, you know? And so you can see this. So this is what I would say. It's like, this is definitely like a movie you can watch, but as I'm reading it, I'm seeing these things in my head and I'm like, this is crazy. We know it's coming because it started, you know, the book starts with this. So it's not a mystery what happens to her, but you can see it over time, like how it unfolds. But then, like you said, weaving in all the other things that were going on at the same time and how she kind of just got pulled into things that were, do you think maybe she didn't realize like how big of a deal this was and how much she was getting, you know, sucked into this and how dangerous it was going to be for her?
I mean, she lived on the edge. She was reckless as one of her paramours described her, but no, I don't think anyone realized, you know, how where this was going. I mean, she was reading, you know, so when Samuel Seabury uncovered this ring of crooked cops in the women's court, She read about that, and she read McLaughlin's name. He was one of the cops who was implicated in framing women. And this jived with her suspicions that she had been framed by Officer McLaughlin, 7 years earlier. And so she reached out to the Seabury Commission and said, I have a story to tell. And they invited her in for an interview. But that's at the point, that's where she sent those letters that you mentioned. She sent these triumphant letters to her ex-husband, to the vice cop McLaughlin, gloating that she was going to go talk to the commission and she was going to tell them everything. And it was just too bad for you, as I think she put it to her ex-husband, and, how she was going to get her, Benita back finally. And, to her, this was like a way to both finally get the revenge that she'd been seeking and to finally be reunited with her beloved daughter, who's by at this point 16 years old. She had been 8 when or 7 when Vivian Gordon had been arrested.
Did you find evidence or anything that would say that her husband was involved in this, or do you feel that was just something that she decided or put those things together?
I did not find any evidence to think that Bischoff had actually conspired with the vice cop. The vice cop was certainly crooked. Mm-hmm. Her arrest was certainly dubious. The vice cop had, one of the reporters visited his apartment. He had this luxurious apartment, his wife was dressed beautifully, and they had all these Persian rugs and beautiful furniture. So they also later found out he had these bank accounts that could not be explained by his meager salary. Okay. So he was definitely a crook. I'm not persuaded that her ex-husband actually set her up. Although he did, I think, exploit the fact that she was arrested mm-hmm. to take custody of Benita. And then that was his excuse for, not letting her see her mother because, your mother's a fallen woman. We can't. So he may have concocted some story about why her mother couldn't see her anymore. There's a very sad note, poignant note that Benita sent her mother like soon after she's incarcerated. Saying like, I can't, I hope to see you again soon. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry you're not feeling well. So,
she had to be told something. So she said, your mom's not well. She's somewhere off getting well or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was very sad. But yeah, that was the question I had too. It's like, I don't know. She could have just extrapolated that from because she already sure hated this guy, and said, because of the way, like you said, he exploited it. So that didn't, that would kind of fall into that idea that he had something to do with it. But yeah, I mean, it's an amazing story. So what was about this story? Like as you started to research, as you're writing, was there something that kind of was really surprising to you that you learned? I mean, besides the whole story, but anything specific as you, that was a surprise to you that you didn't expect?
I think what surprises everybody, surprised me and surprises everyone that I talked to about it was this crazy conspiracy that was going on in the court system. I mean, it's, I think we think of corruption as this, it's all about money and, building inspectors get bribed, but it doesn't, it's a little bit victimless sometimes it seems. Uh-huh. But here was this instance of corruption that was anything but victimless, and really horrifying, and that it was going on for years in New York City, just undetected, was stunning to me. It was stunning to people at the time. I mean, as FDR, as governor, we talked about, he was, he put out a statement saying how shocked he was and how he would pardon, any of the women who had been framed by this ring. So yeah, that was certainly stunning.
It really was. I read that part twice because I'm like, what? I had never heard of that. Again, it was something else in history I'd never heard about. Like, I didn't know. Like, I was trying to figure out, like, why are they doing this? And yes, it's money, but you're right. That's, I think, the thing that takes it over the top is the fact that it ruined the lives of these women, many of them who were innocent of anything. You know, maybe just they were just wrong place at the wrong time, or, you know, somebody said, we don't like her too much. Like, who knows? It could have been anything. So that was an amazing. But there's so much, like I said at the beginning, there's so much to the story. There's so many other, like peripheral stories that go along with this, about all the different politicians and all the people, players and the bishop, of course. We didn't even talk about him, but that's, he's a very interesting character as well. It's just a beautiful book, you guys. I actually have a couple of copies that your publisher gave to me. So I'm going to be gifting those to a couple of listeners, and we'll have information about that at the end of the show. I'll let you guys know how you can get those. But I mean, there's some amazing photographs in here. Did you find, who found these photographs of all of these historical, people? You even got the detective. If you want to know what the handsome detective looks like, you find him in the book. There's just how did you get all of these photographs? These are amazing.
My editor and someone, a photo editor that she employed, were responsible for picking the photos. I mean, I was coming across them all the time as I was doing my research, because there were these photos were all over the newspapers, particularly the Daily News, which was America's first tabloid.
I remember reading about that too. Like, it's small enough to read on the subway. Perfect. Lots of pictures, lots of headlines.
Exactly. That was another idea. Nobody really quite realizes where the term tabloid came from. It was tabloid size was basically a half of a conventional newspaper. I saw all these photos but they're, it's not necessarily easy to get the rights to them. And I'm so glad that my publisher, my editor, figured out how to, how to get these rights and, put these pictures in the book, because they add so much, I think, color, even though they're black and white, to the story and, to see these people. I mean, I did my best to describe them, but I think the photos add a lot.
Yeah, you guys got to get the print version, because you got to see the photos. and there's a lot. I mean, it's a beautiful book. It's a great story, and you did a great job telling it. And I really appreciate your time today, letting my listeners know about it. I'm so glad that your publisher reached out to me and I found out about your book, because I'm having a great time. I'm not all the way through. I'm most of the way through, but having a great time reading it. And I'll go back and look at those pictures more than a few times, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Esther. Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Once again, I'd like to thank my guest, Michael Wohlreich. The Bishop and the Butterfly is a beautifully researched and written book. And as you heard, I love that it's filled with historical photos, too. You can find out more about Michael and find links to his books and articles at michaelwohlreich.com. There's a link in the show notes. Michael's publisher was kind enough to provide me with two copies to give to my listeners. If you'd like a chance to receive one, go to our Instagram page at Once Upon a Crime Pod. Under the post for this episode, like and comment tagging two friends. We'll draw two winners on April 19th. Good luck! Once Upon a Crime is written and produced by me, Esther Sanchez Ludlow. My executive producer is Lorena Garcia. To find out more about the show and access over 300 episodes from our back catalog, go to our website, truecrimepodcast.com. You can also find episodes of Once Upon a Crime on YouTube, Spotify, Amazon Music, and most podcast players. Until next time, be good to one another.